It's the New Books and Literary Studies podcast. I am one of your hosts, Philip Woodaveen, and my guest today, Kimberly Fain, is a professor of English at Houston Community College and most recently the author of Black Hollywood, A History of African-American Men in Film. Today, though, we're going to be talking about her next most recent book, Colson Whitehead, and its eponymous subject, Colson Whitehead, the fiction writer. Kim, thanks for being on.
Thank you.
So, as I just mentioned, this is not your most recent book. You're very prolific, but rather the one that came just before it. So you've just released two books, but it should be mentioned that Colson Whitehead was published in May, Black Hollywood in June. So you must have been working on these books more or less simultaneously. Is that correct? So do you find, I mean, you're working on these two big books at the same time. Do you find there's a lot of, is there overlap there? Are you thinking along the same trains of thought in both books, or what was your experience doing that?
Yes, there was overlap. One thing that overlapped was Black masculinity came up in both books. So I had that on my mind as a running theme for both Colson Whitehead as well as Black Hollywood.
Alrighty. And we'll get into that further. But I guess now, I mean, where you are now in November, you've just finished these two big projects. Where do you go from there? Where's your head at now? Are you mostly focusing on the teaching, or is there another book idea that you're working on as well?
I do have another book idea. I'm keeping it close.
Right.
but it will have something to do definitely with identity and definitely Black identity. It probably will go beyond the scope of Black males and encompass African Americans as a whole. But that's probably the direction of it.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing I did notice to speak about starting from a place of Black masculinity and then getting more into the Black identity as a whole. In the book that you mostly focus on, in this book, Colson Whitehead, it's his first debut novel, The Intuitionist. You're focusing on a character called Lila Mae Watson, and you sort of position her in that place of transition where she's in the tradition of like a Ralph Ellison or a Wright or maybe even a James Baldwin, where it's the Black male. But do you see that as a point of transition, a point of departure, where you're getting more into Black femininity?
You know what, interestingly, I remember reading that initially when Colson Whitehead started writing this. I think he was thinking of more of a male protagonist, and then he changed it to a female protagonist.
Right.
But generally, he'll focus on Black males as his protagonist, main character. On this section, when I was talking about the chapters that were devoted to the intuitionist, I did focus a little bit on Black female femininity, but still at the same time, I was still connecting her experience to the Black male experience. So I still found myself going back to my main point of interest right now.
For sure. And you would say that the Black male identity, I mean, it's certainly the topic of Black Hollywood. Do you find that in your work leading up to this point, has that been a major critical preoccupation for your writing, or is that something that you return to often? How do you think about that?
I think it's a main focus, because race, gender, and class are three topics that intersect, and I am still amazed by, so I continue to write about them. I think that it's rare when you have a Black female writing and focusing on Black male identity. So I like that space where, although Black male identity is a popular topic right now, you don't have a lot of females writing on it. So it still provides an opportunity for me to distinguish myself from other Black female writers who will focus more on femininity, Black female issues. If I focused on that, I would be one of many.
For sure. So I guess, I mean, we're getting a little bit far ahead of ourselves, and I'm very interested in what you have to say about identity and about this idea of double consciousness that I think maybe as a female Black woman, you sort of get a beginning of a triple consciousness that you hint at in the book. But before we really get into that, I was hoping you might help me sketch just like a thumbnail portrait of Colson Whitehead for those listeners who might not already be familiar with his work. So he's a fiction writer. His debut novel, The Intuitionist, came out in 99 and won the Penn Faulkner Award. And and from there, he went on to be a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle and the Pulitzer. And
For John Henry Days, he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. And he's written two nonfiction books, Colossus of New York, which focuses on New York, post 9/11 New York, and then another nonfiction, The Noble Hustle, which is focusing on a poker tournament. His other books are novels. Other than Intuitionist, you have John Henry Days, and then you have Apex, Hives the Hurt, and Zone One, which is about zombies.
Yes.
That was one of his very popular books. So I would say right now he probably is the, you know, Richard Wright, Roth Ellison of our time, Black male author that gets probably the most attention.
All righty. I mean, this is a corpus that you get really very into in the book. You detail Whitehead's literary accomplishment at length, but I guess I'm curious, what drew you to Colson Whitehead initially, just as a reader, not necessarily as a scholar or a professor, but just as a reader?
Well, initially, I saw a call for papers. Keenan Norris was writing a book on street lit, and as the editor, he wanted a number of authors to analyze different writers that had delved into street lit. And one of them that was listed is he wanted essay or chapter on Colson Whitehead, specifically Zone One. And about the post-apocalyptic zombies that take over, New York and the streets of New York, I should say. And that was the first time that I really delved into Colson Whitehead. So I said, okay, let me read this book before I, answer this call for papers. And I felt like Colson, he was doing something different than other writers. And so I, got really into the book and I submitted, I proposed something to Keenan and Keenan accepted it. And so it became a part of his book, his book on street lit.
Gotcha. Maybe this is a difficult question to answer, but could you maybe like think of a word to define what it is that he was doing that separated him? I mean, it seems like you came at Colson not initially as just a reader, but as a critic. What was that thing that set him apart? What do you think appealed him to you?
I think with Colson Whitehead, he definitely is emblematic of the postmodern age. But you don't really have, although Black male issues are very topical right now, you don't really have too many Black male authors that write creatively that you hear about. Mm-hmm. You have Victor Revelle, and you have Matt Johnson, and Colson Whitehead, and they happen to all three be friends. But other than that, you're not really hearing a lot of names on a regular basis. And so for me, that distinguished him. And then in addition to that, his writing tends to be very experimental. I love the lengthy sentences and how descriptive he is in his language when he writes.
Do you, just out of curiosity, do you teach Colson Whitehead, or is he just your own interest that you're studying on your own?
As an adjunct at Houston Community College, I teach composition and research. And so there are many different authors I teach, but he's not one of them now.
All righty. So I guess moving a little further into what the book is about, and about you as a scholar, the sense that I get from the introduction to the book is that you come at your own criticism sort of from between two poles. So on the one hand, you have scholarship on the African diaspora, and it has its own canon like Du Bois, Hurston, Ellison. And then you have the mainstream journals on the other hand that you say, that singularly discuss Whitehead in terms of technological advancement and the horror genre, yet they neglect issues of marginalization and race that are both subtle and obvious. So the question that comes out of that is, where do you see yourself fitting between these traditions as a critic?
I think I think I'm a combination of both because of that dual identity. I'm African American, but I'm a Black person living in America. So I can't help but to bring, when I analyze, I'm always thinking of mainstream American authors as well as American authors and then scholars that come from that are white and Black. It's impossible for me to analyze work really without bringing in both of those identities.
What do you think sets you apart as a critic? Is there anything about your own individual experience that you bring to criticism that you think is original? Is there something about, is there something about what you're looking for in good writing that you often find yourself putting into criticism?
I think several things make me different. One thing, I'm able to write in many different genres in terms of I write creatively, very different genres within nonfiction, but also I think my legal background.
Right.
There are not a lot of scholars or cultural critics who that I'm aware of that are attorneys. And so when I analyze a work, I really try to come from an objective place. Even though I have an argument, I have a position that I'm going for, I still can't help but to break it down and analyze it in depth for the audience.
Right. That was an interesting point that I noted. So you are actually a JD. That's part of your...
Yes. I got the law degree as well as I'm licensed to practice law.
Right. Okay. And I sort of saw that reflected a little bit in the way you were describing what I would think of as moral agency. So when you're talking about equality and freedom, these are words that are, as you say, that come out of the Constitution. So do you find the language of legal practice affecting the way you think about fiction or literature?
I try not to use the language, but the themes of it. And that whole concept of, I guess you could say, it overlaps with the American dream. And then this kind of concept of in America, we have this idea that, you know, you can achieve no matter what. But then what gives us that sort of belief is, you know, it's rooted in the Constitution, it's rooted in the Declaration of Independence. And so I like to get to those, you know, roots. And then I analyze from there, you know, the author. Are those themes coming up repeatedly? And I think with Coulson, the whole concept of the American dream, even though he doesn't use those words, that phrasing, it keeps coming up in every single thing that he writes.
Okay. So let's get into The Intuitionist more seriously, just as a single work. Could you maybe give us an idea of what the book is about and what themes are recurring in that work in particular?
Okay. Well, you have Lila Mae Watson, and she's an elevator inspector. And as an inspector, you have two schools of thought. You have the intuitionist versus the empiricist. And the intuitionists, they sort of kind of just feel what is wrong with the elevator and they diagnose it. And then you have the empiricists who are more based on a fact, a cold hard facts. And they check the structure. And so you have this elevator that, you know, breaks down. And Lila Mae basically has to go underground because they're trying to pin it on her, even though, you know, she hasn't done anything wrong. And when he goes underground, it's, you know, very reminiscent of Invisible Man with Ralph Ellison. And that's where a lot of people make the connection between the two. And again, with Lila Mae, she's like the first female. So she has to deal with issues of race, but then as well as deal with the issues of just gender, of being isolated further and experiencing even further alienation.
Okay, so we've got an alienated protagonist who is trying to clear her name. And this is all happening within the context of elevators, basically. Does that sound like a good description?
Well, yeah, it's like a detective. I guess you could say it's like a detective story because you have, you know, gangsters who are running around and And the elevator symbolizes something. It kind of symbolizes mobilization, which is another thing that comes up a lot in fiction. And it's as a symbol, it deals with the elevation of mankind and our ability to create structures that represent our greatness and our possibilities, but also it represents the ability to, you know, get away from the restrictions of society. So he's using something that is a simple idea to also represent technology as well and progress.
I'm glad you bring that up because in one quote you pull to describe The Intuitionist, you say this is a book drenched in allegory, and you call the book itself a symbolic sociocultural act. And then later you'll go on to call it a novel in which every word bears consequence and every object or place represents a concept grander than itself. So I'm curious as to how you're approaching The Intuitionist as a work of allegory. We've got this idea of elevation. Is there anything else that we can pull from the text that's more than just what it is literally?
Well, you have one character, you have Fulton, and he's a character that has a black mother as well, a white father, and he appears to be white. So he gets many of the advantages at this time of, you know, what comes with access of being And so he's come up with this kind of like idea of this second elevation. And when he creates, and it's connected to elevators, but this second elevation that will change society forever. And and that's something that is kind of like that a major theme, something that Lila May kind of in a way almost worships in like a religious way. His school of thought. And so it ties into, again, that whole concept of mobility.
And he's the, so Fulton, if we flesh this guy out a little bit, he's the founder of Intuitionism, is that correct? So he's the founder of Intuitionism that Lila May is sort of a part of or sees herself as descending from. But that means that she's a black woman who's part of a tradition founded by a man who is black but can pass as white.
Well, he's passing. He is passing. He passed. But still, for her, race is not really a factor to her. Race is something that's on her. She really looks at herself. Her focus is her abilities, and that's kind of very characteristic of Colson Whitehead novels. That for the character, oftentimes their race is not an issue for them. However, there are other characters in the book who treat them in a certain way that make race an issue.
Okay. Let's get into race a little bit, because I think a lot of what you're reading out of Colson Whitehead, I mean, I haven't personally read it, but it seems a lot of what Colson is writing about, and then what therefore you're writing about, is revolving around race. So the idea of race, and there's a great quote in the book that's it's Bell Hooks who says, even though race is not a taboo topic in today's culture, many folks are unable to talk race without perpetuating racist thoughts and actions. So to me, it seems like race is like a fraught term that comes up in your writing. And of course, there's that great satirical editorial that you mention, The Year of Living Post-Racially, where Colson Whitehead's talking about how it comes down to just melanin in the body. So I guess I'm curious how you think about that. Is race a cultural construct to you as you're reading Colson Whitehead, or is it something else?
Well, I think the two things are going on here. One of the reasons why I gave it the title, The Post-Racial Voice of Colson Whitehead, The Post-Racial Voice of Contemporary Literature, is because Colson Whitehead, you know, says, and I quote it in the book, that he doesn't really necessarily believe in the term post-racial. However, my argument is, although he uses it satirically, his characters and his themes oftentimes are post-racial, meaning that race, again, for the character is not really an issue. And his themes go beyond race. However, at the same time, we live in a race-conscious society. So we can choose not to ignore it. But for an African-American person, that's something we confront on a daily basis. And I wouldn't say just African-Americans. I would say people of color in general confront. So it does keep coming up in the writing. But it comes up more in the writing of his intuitionist and John Henry days, because those books are set more in historical fiction in the past. And so when you start getting with Sag Harbor, you're talking about more of the 1980s. Then you get into Zone One and you're talking about the future. It's not really, it's still a theme, but it's not the prominent theme, because I think that although we live in a race conscious society, I think Colson Whitehead as a writer, I don't think he wants to be pigeonholed with it. People just seeing his work as African-American fiction, or just seeing his work in terms of racial issues. I think he wants his work to apply to people in general.
Right. Yeah, and I want to push you a little bit further on that, because I think it, just as race is a fraud term, so is this idea of post-racial. And I think the way, I mean, the context for that editorial that Colson Whitehead writes about living post-racially is in response to the election of Barack Obama. And the way you describe it is, quote, "Post-racialism suggests that America's election of our first African-American president is a signifier that racism no longer exists." And so this is something that you delve into and ultimately reject. But I'm curious what that word means to you as you're using it to think about Colson Whitehead's writing. I mean, you say that he's writing in a world that suggests post-racial. I guess I'm just asking you to explain that a little further.
One of the things I say is that my belief is that there's a certain level of literary angst that Colson has as a writer. It's a conflict in a way. On one hand, there is, I believe, the writer's personal belief, which is that race is still an issue. But then there's his desire as a writer. And it's like he creates these worlds, or creates these characters, where in an ideal world, a person or human being would not have to face those issues on a daily basis. And I think he creates a world in his fiction, in his latter books, where his characters don't have to be confronted with these issues. For example, with Zone One, the audience is not even aware that Marx, the protagonist, is even African-American. They don't discover them until they get far into the book. And even then, it's only mentioned in like a sentence. So it's not an issue at all. So I think there's two things going on here. There's the world in which we live that keeps confronting Colson. And then there's the world he creates, where in his latter books, race is not as much of a factor.
Okay. So you're talking about the latter books as emphasizing a more post-racial ideal as opposed to reality. So it seems like when we talk about a post-racial world, we're talking about something that is still only complete in can only be complete in a fictional world. So it's not a reality that we have. Is that right?
Yeah, it's almost like, and I refer to it as mythological, because you start having people trying to use it in a political context. And it really has no bearing. Actually, it is mythologized. It's a mythological idea that people want to believe in, but all evidence points towards other factors. And ironically, after I wrote the book, we even had more racial issues that started occurring in the news that made it more obvious that definitely we are not in a post-racial era. I think that's aspirational. I think many of us Americans would like that to be true.
Okay. And so you say this is a feature mostly of his latter fiction, or his latter writing, not necessarily fictional. I guess I'm curious about how this idea of post-racial, so this word of post-racial, this idea of a post-racial society, how does that look in one of his earliest books, not his latter books, but in The Intuitionist, with this character we've just been introduced to, Lila Mae Watson, is post-racial life aspirational for her, even in the fiction? Or what do you think about that?
World, for her, it's not post-racial at all, but for Fulton it is, because Fulton is passing. And to me, that's right. A form of post-racialism when race is not a factor for him, because people know about his race. And so that's one area where I think people start feeling like you can go beyond race as an issue when economically a person doesn't have to deal with it because their education status is high. And then as well, when you start almost in a way adopting a white identity, then you, in your mind, you don't have to deal with race. It's not really, she would love for people to just look at her work as it is.
Right.
That's the whole idea of a post-racial society, meaning that race is just not a factor. Very ideal. Mm. Okay. But so she would like it not to apply to her. And then you basically have Fulton kind of living in this world where when he talks about the second elevation, nothing matters. Mm. Class, race, nothing matters. Everyone is going to ascend to higher heights, according to his theory of intuitionism.
Okay, that's very interesting. One thing I'm curious about as well is how, and you do mention this, W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, which is, as far as I can tell, where this idea of double consciousness originates. So, could you maybe quickly gloss that idea of double consciousness? What is, when you use that in criticism, what does it mean?
Well, his theory was that, for the African-American, that you have two warring souls. Again, you have the identity as an American, as well as the identity, the terminology he used, Negro. And you have these two identities that are really, really opposed to each other. Because, again, you have a situation where there's the rights that people get as citizens to make them American. But then, especially at the time that Du Bois is writing, you have African-Americans who are not able to access full citizenship. They're being denied many of their rights in this Jim Crow era. And so you have to deal with two realities. There's the reality of what you should get as being an American citizen, and then there's the reality in which you live. So it creates a double consciousness, and in a way you can find yourself maybe only being able to show one side of yourself, and that's why I talk a lot about the mask and the veil. And the intuitionist, because that's something that Lila May has to deal with. She has a veil, His veil is the white mask, passing as a white individual when he wrote black identity.
So, would you say for a character like Fulton, who is able to pass, is his consciousness sort of integrated? Does he have only one consciousness as of an American? He's no longer.
I think that's probably how he wanted to be seen. But, there's how you perceive yourself, and then there's your reality. So his reality, especially, we don't get from Coulson the exact time period of this, but we know it's kind of like pre-civil rights or right around the beginning of the civil rights movement. Mm. And so, especially at that time, definitely, even though having any black identity in America and based on American laws, he was still considered an African American. So, regardless of how he would have considered himself for the time period that he was living, he would be perceived as American. And his rights, if it was known who he was, his identity, he would have been denied opportunity.
Right.
It's that simple. So.
Right. Okay. Just to cap that idea off, because I'm just now learning about this whole thing. Could we say that one of the markers of a post-racial society, beyond just an aspirational idea or an ideal, would be a single consciousness or no double consciousness, where you're just American and you're just whoever else you are, but there's no conflict?
Well, ironically, like I said, even now so much has happened since having published this. I think because you have a situation where white Americans eventually will be the minority within a decade or two, I think even the way white Americans are perceived in this country is going to change, and the way they perceive themselves is going to change. So I think that we're even further away from that idea. As we become more integrated and more multiracial, I think we're getting even further from the idea of post-racialism, because the idea of a post-racial society is that the fact that you're Black, Hispanic, or whatever your race is of color, that will not matter because white identity is dominant. That's the idea, you know, 2009. Well, now that you're not going to really have one identity that is dominating, I think we're even further away from a post-racial society, because I think everyone is going to kind of feel like a minority, including whites.
That's interesting.
And that's kind of how I'm feeling about it. Just from my conversations with white colleagues, they themselves are thinking about race for the first time and thinking about their white identity for the first time. And what does it mean? And is there privilege, and are they starting to lose that privilege? And these are honest discussions that I appreciate that they trust me enough to talk to me about it. So post-racialism is really, again, a satirical term. And I think that, again, you know, you can write a character that you can write a book where your characters don't confront race. But again, it would be fiction. It is definitely.
Right. Okay, so I guess that kind of brings up an interesting idea. For a white person in this country up until now, and maybe not in the future, but up until now, being white or whiteness, this idea of being white is something that you or that we've never had to had to think about what it means. But blackness is much different. It's something that you do have to think about. It's something that affects your daily life. So you take Morrison's study on the construct of blackness and whiteness in American literature as the basis for a lot of your thinking. I'm wondering if you can kind of give us Morrison's idea, or maybe an idea that you have yourself that is contributed to by Morrison's idea of what blackness means and what it means, what the big abstract noun of blackness means, taken from just being Black or just the everyday blackness of the individual.
Well, I think that in general, for Black people, you have two things going on. You have invisibility and hypervisibility. And certain spaces you might be ignored, and people don't really even pay attention to you or give you access or give you the same information. And that's a form of invisibility. But then hypervisibility is when you are accused of things, or people are suspicious of you, or if you, you know, walk into a store and you're followed, or if, you know, as I've been told by some of my students, you know, and I've been told this by maybe, you know, some of my white students, they'll be sitting, you know, with their Black friends, and they're all doing the same thing, whatever this thing is, but only their Black friend is questioned and whatever activity they're engaged in. And that's an example of the hypervisibility. Of just the assumption that somehow you're involved in something that you shouldn't be involved in. So I think that that is, and again, it's hard to explain to someone who is not a person of color. However, I think that if a white person is dating a person of color, I think they become very aware of it and they start to notice it. And I think they have children, they may have a child that is a person of color, that's when I think a white person becomes aware of this hypervisibility of blackness or Black skin.
Okay. Is there anything else that we should sort of attach to that? I mean, the idea of blackness is something that has a different visibility, whether it be less or more. Is there anything more that we can take out of just that quality of being Black? Or
Well, I think that, again, I think that sometimes people don't understand that you want to celebrate. I think it's a combination of you want to celebrate that heritage and you want to introduce that heritage, and you want definitely things that you're proud of, the artistic achievements and different accomplishments. You want that to be acknowledged. because there is definitely a desire to be a part of the American system. I don't think we would have had the civil rights movement. I don't think you would have Black writers writing the issues that they write if they didn't want to be a part of this American milieu. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you want to be a part of it. You don't want to be held to a harsher standard.
Right.
You want to be looked at on more of an equal level playing field. So I think that's definitely, you know, a takeaway from that. And I think that is what Colson Whitehead tries to do as an author, is that he really, you know, wants to be one of the great American writers of all time. Probably not one of the greatest Black, but one of the great American of all time. So I think the struggle he has as an author, or the desire he has as an author, comes out in the way that he portrays his characters in his novel.
That's a great segue. I'm wondering if you can maybe, if we can maybe ground this idea of Blackness in a Black character that Colson Whitehead is writing about. So I guess the example that's coming to my mind is when Lila May is posing as a maid in order to gather information. I didn't fully grasp that scene, but I gather that she's able to... She has access to places and situations that she normally wouldn't, just for the reason that she's overlooked. Could you maybe go into that that scene and that idea a little more?
Well, I chose that scene because I thought it was very interesting that this is a work function and she poses as a maid. And even though she is at the function with people that know her, they don't recognize her. So she is invisible to her coworkers, bosses, because they don't realize it's her. Just a change of her uniform from the uniform that she wears as an inspector to the uniform that you would wear as a maid, her Black face kind of just blends in. And that lets you know that they don't really see her as an individual, okay? They see her just as a Black person, because they really should recognize her. She's the only Black female, you know, inspector. And so at the same time, she is invisible. She uses this opportunity to, she takes advantage of this invisibility to get information to help clear her name. And I liked that. I liked how you see a character taking a situation that is negative and hurtful and saying, okay, I'm going to use this to my advantage. The fact that they don't
realize
it's me, I can get intel that can help clear my name.
Yeah. I guess a question that stems from that whole idea is this is kind of a trope of detective fiction. She's gathering, as you say, she's gathering intel, and she's sort of snooping around and trying to build a case for herself, as it turns out. But in the book you say that critical claims by Toni Morrison, or there are critical claims by Toni Morrison that Poe is essential to the context of the racial discourse of his day. And of course, Poe is where we get the entire idea of a mystery story in the first place. I'm curious whether or not Poe is in any way influencing Colson Whitehead's writing, if it's a detective story, and if Poe is still having an influence on the racial discourse of today as well.
Well, I think that what I noticed is that there was one author that made reference to two of Poe's stories, actually three of them. And I said, okay, this is a great idea, but they didn't make reference to The Mask of the Red Death. And I felt like I wanted to make that connection because I hadn't seen that connection. Because they made that connection, and I love Poe. I said, okay, so I analyzed the detective elements that they were getting from, you know, the murders in the Rue Morgue. And I said, let me break down Mask of the Red Death, which is my favorite Poe's short story. And in it, you have this whole death is invisible to the people, and death is wearing a mask as well. And I was like, wow. So there goes that concept of invisibility and the mask. Then many people, when they interpret the Mask of the Red Death, they interpret it through the lens of class. And just kind of like the changes in class in, you know, let's say Europe, although Poe's story takes place in America. And I said, okay, well, you know, oftentimes where there's class issues, they overlap with race issues. And so I looked at death again, they describe death as this darkness and something that, you know, is a horror and fearful. And I said, well, some of the terminology that he's using for death is some of the Chinese terminology when an African-American is insulted is used. And so I decided to, you know, make that connection in that chapter
right.
where I'm talking about the invisibility of Lila May, how she represents change. So she is feared. And with, you know, Black Plague, he represents change as well, a form of cleansing. And so he is feared as well.
So it's like we're building this concept, this abstract concept of blackness, and it's part of that is coming from the idea of death and fear. So it's and invisibility. So it's I'm just going to point out. I think that's very interesting that you you're comparing a personification of death as coming from the same place of blackness or fear or invisibility that you would get in a racial context. So that's a really interesting connection, I think. I guess one big question that I felt the first couple chapters kind of tilted on like an axial point, a little hinge in the first part of the book was, if we are not living in a post-racial society, are we in an era of post-blackness? And I really like that question. I mean, we've sort of built up this idea of blackness both from Lila May and going all the way back to Poe. I guess I'm curious if you could go into further detail on what it means, if not to be post-racial, then to be post-black.
Well, I think with intuitionists and John Henry Days, I think of those two texts as being post-black. And I guess the definition between post-blackness and post-racial is blackness is considered to be something very positive and positive by artists. And it's this idea that your art should be interpreted not just within racial lens, but your art should be interpreted within the context of many other themes that affect a person's life, education, class, so on and so forth. And it has this positive connotation, whereas post-racial, when you look at something from that context, it's when you ignore race. It's when you reject race, it's when you pretend it doesn't exist. And, you know, many African-American artists are not comfortable with that idea. Your race just does influence your art, just like a person who has Italian ancestry or Jewish ancestry, that influence their work. Blackness is no different. But for some reason in our society, we look at it as something different when that's natural for any group. Their identity is going to come out naturally. So post-black, you look at probably that's definitely positive. And it's just, it's acting out of the preconceived notions of what people believe black people can do and what they can be.
Right. There's a great quote that kind of corroborates what you're saying. You say, you would argue that post-blackness is, whether intentionally or unintentionally, a performance of existing outside of the prescribed black identity that has manifested from past exclusion and systematic racism. So we have, in a way, a term that's bigger but also less specific. And it seems like, to me, that there's many different ways that you can be post-black as opposed to black. So does that sound correct to you?
Yes, definitely.
If you're a black artist and you're creating.
I think that that's definitely how you want to be seen. Like, I'm able to write on many other topics than I have in terms of essays I've written on white female gender issues. I'm able to write about all of those. But I keep coming back to this one, black male identity, because to me, it's not solved. It's not solved.
Gotcha.
And it's not being kind of fixed in society. So I keep trying to propose solutions. And I think that what makes me a post-black artist is this ability to write on many different genres. And I have many different interests. And just like Poe is an interest of mine and Toni Morrison, I insist upon, even when I write something on black people, I insist upon bringing in those European American influences that I came up with, because I see a connection. I see more of a connection between blacks and whites than I see a separation. So I keep trying to bring it into the work, hoping that my readers will see a connection.
Right.
You know, more in common than differences. I tried to get, I think, whites to kind of step into the black persona, and feel it and experience, as well as I want Blacks to kind of see the other side as well, the European American perspective.
Yeah, and there's a great quote from the book, actually, where you say it's a contentious yet interdependent relationship between between the races, any race. And you say a study of Blackness must inevitably be paired with a study of whiteness in our American milieu. So that is a great point. We're reaching the 50-minute mark, so I won't hold you for too much longer. First of all, thank you hugely for coming on and talking to me about your book. I guess as just like a final question, and I guess this relates more maybe to the subject matter of Black Hollywood, but it's more about popular culture and popular media. I was just wondering if I could get a word on Django Unchained, because that's probably the biggest, for me, at least the people that I've talked to about this idea prior to this book, that's the biggest point of reference. So where do you stand on that? Are you on the Spike Lee side, or what do you think about Django Unchained?
Okay, well, I'll tell you something interesting. In Black Hollywood, I do address Django Unchained, as well as I have a chapter on Spike Lee. I'm actually a fan of both Quentin Tarantino and Spike Lee, so I'm able to kind of consider what they say about their work and how they present their work, I think from an objective lens. But one of the things I argue with Quentin Tarantino is that he has explored Black male identity quite profoundly with the main character, with Django. I mean, he really deals with him in-depthly and explores his feelings and treats him very human. Mentioned that in Black Hollywood, but also I think that what was off-putting for some people is what people thought was the overuse of the N-word. However, at that time, and that character was living, that word would be used pretty much regularly and often. So I thought that it was kind of realistic. In terms of Spike criticizing Quentin Tarantino, I think that Spike criticizes Tyler Perry as well. So Spike does not care if you are Black or white. He considers you competition. And so I consider it to be a competition thing for him. And I think that is, Spike keeps himself in the conversation. Even when it's your movie, Spike is keeping himself in the conversation. So I think he is doing what he should do as a provocateur. He's good at provoking thought and getting people interested. And I think he actually helps send people to the theater. So Quentin Tarantino should say thank you, Spike, for being, so animated about the film, because I think it helped with sales, to be honest with you.
Right. Actually, this really gets to a question I've had for a while. And it kind of gets to that whole double consciousness thing. I'm kind of curious where you would draw the line between cultural appropriation and cultural appreciation. So it seems like, and I kind of agree with you, I'm not really as studied on this, but I enjoy Django Unchained, and I saw Quentin Tarantino's side of it. I guess, where would you stand on somebody like Iggy Azalea? Is she appropriating or appreciating, do you think?
I definitely would say she's appropriating. My problem with Iggy is that I think she's Australian. And so it just, to me, seems like, where are the themes of being a person of Australian descent? Where are the themes of even being a young white person growing up in a Black milieu? Where are those themes? So to me, my understanding is that other people, were writing her lyrics, which is fine. That's what some singers have done for them. But I was wondering where her identity was. So not only does she borrow this Black identity, but then I was troubled by the fact that she didn't speak to any of the racial concerns that Blacks were having at the time when she had this kind of pulpit. And then the other issue is that I don't think she knew where the hairstyles and the language that she was using came from. So it's appropriation when you don't know the history of it. There's nothing wrong with someone of another color. I think borrowing the ideas and using them and making art from it, because to me, that's what being an American is. And Quentin Tarantino, that's why I respect him. He knows the history behind what he does. He knows why he's doing it. He gets that connection between blackness and whiteness. But with Iggy, I feel like she was kind of a puppet, and she wasn't really sure. And that's why we're not really hearing from her too much now. She was and then when she got criticized, she was quick to call blacks racist. And if you have a large black audience, that's kind of like the wrong way to go.
yeah, definitely. So it sounds like what you're saying, that there comes with, if you borrow from a different culture, there comes with that a kind of responsibility to depict it accurately. And that's, and maybe that could be the difference between Tarantino and Iggy, is that Tarantino knew what he was talking about. Does that sound fair?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was clear that he had done research and brought new things to life that I'm sure some African-Americans didn't know about our American history. So if people walk away and they're enlightened historically, like they were entertained and then they were enlightened historically, then I think doing your job as an artist, and he definitely falls under the appreciation category.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that gets me caught up on that is part of my response, I didn't really follow it very closely, to be honest with you, but part of my response to the whole Iggy Azalea firestorm was that, you know, Ralph Ellison wrote that essay, The World in the Jug, and he was sort of responding to the literary criticism that was saying he wasn't, you know, writing out of a black enough place, or he wasn't writing as a black writer enough, and so I've always sort of wondered about that. I was like, where do you get licensed to create art out of somebody else's experience? That was very interesting. I guess, thank you again. I've rambled on for a very long time. It's about an hour now. Thank you so much for joining me and for discussing your book.
Well, thank you, Philip. Oh, and I did want to say that I did have an opportunity to meet Coulson. And I mentioned that in the conclusion. And he was very gracious and very much a gentleman. I very impressed with his reading. I got to hear him read The Noble Hustle. And so that definitely was wonderful while I was writing this, to have that opportunity.
Cool. Thank you again.